Thanks for joining us this morning. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Jackie Fortier, filling in for Larry today as he takes a well-deserved break this week. But if you miss Larry's voice, don't worry. We'll be hearing his conversation with NPR Weekend Edition Saturday's Scott Simon a little later this hour. But first, joining us for our daily update on COVID-19 is Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UCSF Medical Center. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Dr. Chin Hong.
Always a joy, Jackie.
In our 10 a.m. hour, we really did a deep dive into L.A. County's nursing home facilities, which have been hit very hard by the pandemic. I wanted to follow up on that and ask you about any advice you have for listeners who have friends or family members in nursing facilities, how they can safely do visitations if they're allowed, and what they could be doing for their loved ones during this, you know, very isolating time.
Yeah, so I think that's always has been an issue from the beginning of the pandemic. First of all, the issue of isolation, particularly amongst our seniors, and just remembering even our hospitalized seniors when they come in, you know, we've tried to use technology as much as possible. So a lot of FaceTime, iPads, and I know that's not available for everyone, but you'd be surprised how much that helps. And you know, people can do that very frequently instead of like finding parking and going through all of that. But beyond that, an in-person visit is always the best, you know, to see the context and to have the feeling and to touch someone's hand. In that sense, you know, nursing homes vary so much in terms of their architecture and their risk. So I would assess, you know, is it a small cramped area that's doesn't have a window, that will probably be the most risky indoor visits in terms of risk to the person visiting. If you're close to a window, you'd want to open it, of course, wear a mask. Have your loved one wear a mask who you're visiting, if at all possible as well. And, you know, don't forget the three W's of wearing a mask, washing your hands, and watching your distance as much as possible. Of course, if you're wearing a mask and you need to go closer to your loved one, you know, particularly if you have the window a little bit cracked open for ventilation, it's probably going to be as less risky as you could make it.
By the way, if you have medical questions related to COVID-19 for Dr. Peter Chin Hong, we are taking your calls. 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at AirTalk or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Dr. Chin Hong, I'm also kind of curious. A lot of people, you know, maybe don't have access to the internet, or like you said, the residents in a nursing home facility may not have access to an iPad or something along those lines where they could do a FaceTime visit. What about like writing, you know, letters on pieces of paper and sending them through the mail? I mean, does that have the same uplifting effect that maybe a visit does?
Totally. You know, there was a project from our medical students here where they actually wrote to patients as well after their hospitalization. And there was so much positive feedback. I think everyone was surprised by that, even though we recognized that there was some benefit to writing. And, you know, not only writing to the person, but having the person in the nursing home or who's ill write back. I think that old-fashioned exchange is great for so many reasons. First of all, many of our seniors are not technologically literate as much as younger folks are, and you can save it and sort of caress it. There's a texture of paper. There's all these colors you can integrate, and the sort of like free form aspect is therapeutic as well.
If you have any medical questions, please give us a call at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. I'd like to turn now and talk about children. More than 97,000 children in the U.S. have tested positive for coronavirus in the last 2 weeks of July. That's according to a new report that was published by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. What do you make of this study, and what does it tell us of kids' susceptibility to COVID-19?
Yeah, so I think our understanding of how COVID-19 affects children is evolving. And, you know, I think it's frustrating for the public because in the beginning, we'd say, oh, kids are the chosen ones, they're protected. But as more and more information gets out, they're not necessarily protected. They mainly not get COVID not as often, and they're likely not to transmit as often in general compared to adults. But still, there's still, you know, high susceptibility rates. The point is, you don't know which of the kids is going to get ultimately very sick. I mean, if you look at the flat numbers, they're not still not very large. So about, you know, depending on the state, about 1-5% of hospitalizations are due to kids, and they comprise a very small number of deaths, about, you know, less than 1%, so about 0.5% in most places. But when they do get sick, it's very unpredictable, although most people still believe that kids with comorbidities like congenital heart disease or other medical conditions are probably more likely than your regular unaffected kid to get ill from COVID. But it's still something that's evolving. And the more COVID there is in the community, of course, kids will get infected just by chance. And it's about, you know, we think about influenza being mainly a kid thing versus COVID, but there's so much COVID out there now that the number is actually starting to look very similar.
And one thing I do want to point out is that when we talk about kids or pediatrics and in the medical community, that's anyone under the age, it's 17 and under. So you're talking about, you know, teenagers as well as small children. So keep that in mind. I'm curious what implications, you know, this would have for some kids, you know, preparing to go back to school. I mean, what kind of advice would you give in that scenario?
Yeah, so I think about kids, and I'm glad you brought up that age range, because it is a sort of like a bifurcation in general between kids 10 and under and older than 10. In general, the kids 10 and older to adolescents act more like adults, both in terms of getting COVID as well as transmitting COVID. And if you look even at the inflammatory response, that word Kawasaki-like disease that kids can get, It's generally older kids, like 10 and older, although, of course, we've seen younger kids get it as well. Studies in general, apart from one study, has generally shown that kids under 10 are less efficient transmitters as well as less likely to acquire COVID compared to kids over 10. And probably the best study comes from South Korea, where they investigated the cases and their households. And if the index case was a kid, they tried to see what was the probability of having the other members of the family, where there was no protection, test positive by contact tracing. And there was, again, the kids over 10 appeared to be similar in risk to adults.
Let's turn to a question from our listener. Richard in Newport Beach wants to know, for people who have seasonal allergies, would they be more resistant to COVID-19 since their immune systems are already fighting those allergies? Dr. Chin Hong, what do you think?
That's kind of an interesting point. I mean, there is some basic science evidence that if you have an allergic response, it sort of like results in a less serious COVID. But I think that's kind of preliminary. And I think Richard might be onto a good thing there with, you know, that revving up that particular arm of the immune system might actually provide some attenuation of COVID symptoms. But again, it's kind of early to tell, but an intriguing hypothesis borne out by some basic science data that's emerging.
Jordan in San Marino called in to ask, he says, I have a 19-year-old son who suddenly is describing a backache with no apparent reason. His temperature is normal and he hasn't lost his sense of taste or smell. Is that something, Dr. Chin Hong, that you think would be worth watching with regard to coronavirus?
I think in general, Jackie, I've continued to be humbled by the prurient manifestations of COVID. But right now, we don't think that isolated back pain is even one of the broad range of symptoms that people get. But certainly, you know, watching it and continuing to monitor for probably the two, if you want a really simple sort of screen every morning before you go to work, wake up, see if you feel a temperature, and try to smell your coffee or some other fun food that you like. And if you have a fever and you can't smell, those are probably two of the most common things. And of course, there's a broad range, but that's kind of a good screen.
And that is, of course, if you are developing symptoms, there are people who are asymptomatic with COVID-19. If you have a question for Dr. Peter Chin Hong about COVID-19, we are taking your calls. 866-893-5722. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Doctor, there's been a few reports released by the CDC that found racial disparities in children with the virus. We're seeing it in adults, and now, of course, we're seeing it in kids. According to one of the reports, Hispanic children were hospitalized at a rate 8 times higher than white kids. Black children were hospitalized at a rate 5 times higher. What do you make of these disparities? I mean, they're so stark.
They're very stark, and they were really frightening to me when I looked at them as well. But again, it mirrors what we see in adults, although the kids seem to be even more affected in terms of disparities. And what we're seeing in adults where, you know, African-Americans or Latinx are 2 to 3 more times likely to both be diagnosed and to be hospitalized and to die from COVID-19. I think it just reflects the social situation in which kids reside. They're not isolated. So, you know, structural racism, lack of access to care, living in multi-generational households, unable to, you know, protect oneself. You know, those are the same refrain that we think about when we think about disparities in adults also apply to kids, if not more, simply because they don't, depending on the age of the kid, don't usually have agency. So they're at the behest of the adults around them and, you know, more than the adults are.
Maurice on Facebook asks, has there been any evidence of higher transmission cases in hair salons? I know of a lot of hairstylists who have been working throughout the pandemic and they have not contracted COVID-19. Maurice did not say whether or not those hairstylists were wearing masks. But doctor, what do you think? Has there been any evidence of higher transmission in cases in hair salons?
No, actually, I haven't seen any real convincing cases of transmission clusters in hair salons. Of course, it's theoretically possible, but, you know, probably one of the most famous cases in the U.S. recently was, of course, in Missouri, where 2 hairstylists were found to have COVID, and they were symptomatic, but everyone was wearing a mask, and none of the 140 patrons who visited them and had their hair cut by those 2 hairstylists contracted COVID. So it really speaks to 2 things. One is that wearing masks is such an important thing we can do to protect ourselves, so cheap. And number 2 is actually hairstylists, barbers, they need to be certified. And when you're certified, they undergo rigorous training in disinfection and cleaning. So they have really good sensitivity to it. So I don't think of them as the same risk, even though we lump them in with indoor activities as others.
If you have a COVID-19 question for Dr. Peter Chin Hong, we are taking your calls at 866-893-5722. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Charles in Palm Springs wants to know what data the doctor is aware of that tell us about how soon we might get to herd immunity if we get there at all. Doctor?
I think that's a difficult issue. I mean, kind of half glass full person. And in general, herd immunity comes from vaccination studies where you think of the herd of cattle and think of the sick cattle at the back of the herd. To protect those sick cattle at the back of the herd, 70% of the cattle have to be robust and healthy. And that's the idea of herd immunity if some sick cattle come to visit from another herd. In humans, we think about it the same way. If 70% or more of the population is vaccinated, then that protects the 30% of people who didn't get vaccinated for whatever reason. But you have to get up to that 70% number. Of course, vaccination is one way you can get immune. You can also get immune from natural infection. There are a few challenges with that for COVID-19. First of all, it doesn't seem that natural infection with COVID-19 gives us that robust immune response that we normally see with natural infections, say like chickenpox. And unlike, very much like another kind of infection for which there's a vaccine, like HPV, when we get infected with human papillomavirus that causes warts and precancer lesions, that infection seems to be kind of local in many people. So the body doesn't really get that angry and make that immune response. So the vaccine in that case is much better. That brings us to the next problem, which is vaccines. And of course, we've been developing vaccines in a much more rapid phase than people thought with Operation Warp Speed. That sounds kind of science fiction-y, but it's really billions of dollars invested in accelerating the development of vaccines. And there have been lots of good news about vaccines recently, but the problem is it's still going to be, you know, brought out or rolled out in a very tiered approach and would probably be a while before everyone can have vaccine available to them. And most concerningly, when you ask Americans if they're ready for the vaccine, you know, only about 50% or so say they're ready, and they cite safety concerns. And I do think that people will be very careful about safety before they roll out any vaccine. So I'd like to reassure everyone that, you know, it is a concern, but, you know, I'd probably be one of the first people lining up to get the vaccine, honestly.
Well, that's quite an endorsement. Sam from Tustin wants to know, she says her 19-year-old daughter was recently around someone who tested positive for the virus. She's sheltering in place and plans on getting tested Thursday. Is that too soon to get tested? Should she wait until she sees any symptoms? Sam didn't say when her daughter was around the person with the virus. But, I mean, how soon do you think someone should get tested, doctor, if they think that they've been around somebody who has COVID-19?
That's a great question, Jackie. And Sam brings up a very common scenario. And I think generally the incubation period of the virus is about 4 to 7 days. So I'd generally recommend that people get tested within the week, but not too soon because you may have a false negative. So I think anywhere from day 4 to 7 would be kind of a good time period in which to get the test if you've been exposed.
Cameron in West Hollywood says that he was reading that experts are finding a correlation between vitamin D deficiency and contracting COVID-19. Dr. Chin Hong, have you seen evidence of that?
There hasn't really been convincing evidence of that yet. Of course, there's a lot of uncontrolled observational reports that may be the case. But so far, we haven't really gotten to the point where we check vitamin D levels and replace them if someone has COVID-19. Of course, in the past, vitamin D has been the subject of a lot of controversy in medicine. At first, it was sort of like one of the darlings of clinical medicine, and then we repleted everyone in vitamin D, and then later studies came out showing that it didn't really matter. So I think it's being studied now, and I wouldn't do it per se necessarily mm-hmm. as a primary intervention until we see a little bit more data.
Briefly, Tigra tweets and asks, why aren't we seeing COVID-19 ripping through the homeless population if it is as contagious as we are told it is? That's an interesting question. We are seeing a higher rate, unfortunately, in homeless people in Los Angeles County.
Yeah, so first of all, there have been outbreaks in the homeless population. I mean, there was one also in the Bay Area, you know, a few weeks ago. And then what they did was the public health officials in the city went in and sort of like gave them housing. So I think that probably, at least regionally, mm-hmm. does seem to make a difference. But they're not necessarily immune. But there has been a recent, study from the laboratory science or basic science world where they've been trying to understand why some people just don't have serious symptoms when they get COVID and they don't progress. One of the hypotheses is that even though you may not find antibodies in somebody, when they tested T cells, which are sort of like the orchestra, the maestro or the conductor of the whole immune system, and they stimulated them against COVID-19, they found that even in previous years that they did have a response. So maybe folks have some sort of cross-reactivity with other coronaviruses that cause the cold, that make them less susceptible to serious disease.
Thank you, Dr. Chin Hong, for joining me today. That's Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UCSF Medical Center. Coming up next, an extended conversation between Larry and NPR's Scott Simon, the host of Weekend Edition Saturday. Stay tuned for that conversation coming up next on AirTalk on 89.3 KPCC.